Okay, I'm sitting here with Matthew from Solidarity News. Matthew, you want to tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm the editor and sole writer right now for Solidarity News. You can find that at solidaritynews.org. And basically, the website is a news publication for people that are doing good in Eugene and Springfield. So telling stories about labor struggles, reproductive rights, Black Lives Matter across the board, and how, following those and how people can get involved.
So a kind of underreported news.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of stories. I believe I was first one to cover the local Starbucks unionization here, and and there's other ones where it's like it just doesn't get the live day in other big news publications.
So how long has Solidarity News been around?
It's been a bit over 3 years now, I think, coming up for this spring. Started out as just a newsletter, which I still got, and then now it's a full website and published on like social media and stuff.
And so how did you get into writing? Are you a journalist or?
Yeah, so I did work for a media publication as a editor before, and I did a media studies minor in college, and I felt like I've been in a scene, like organizing scene, and I had experience in media, and I felt right to be put those two together, use my skills, and do something helpful.
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty gritty. What do you think is wrong with the media, and why do we need alternative media?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, it's covering it from just one angle. So, like, I remember reading, like, story, and it's talking about, hey, here's what politicians are wanting out of next budget. But I kind of want to see the other side. Like, what do people want? And not just what's happening in, like, the chambers of Congress or the State House, but what's happening on the streets.
And so why do you think they don't report what's on the streets? Who owns the media?
Most of it's just been ad-supported, and it keeps getting bought up, like Red Scar is Gannett, and it's very concentrated into a few arms of. They are cutting reporters and lots of times just kind of republishing stuff from other places, and so it's not as much local coverage.
So it's about selling products more than informing the people.
Yeah, sure.
So I noticed the news. You come away from the news and really depressed. It's kind of depressing to watch the news. What do you suppose that is?
Yeah, I think it really drives a lot of clicks and wants to be that we're in a state of despair or things just like tumbling out. Chaos, and that's helpful to this kind of terror, and it also brings people back to watch it, that you need to be keep up with it, but there are terrible things happen, but I think it's important to have the balance of, like, what are some things people can do to help, and what are people already organizing around, and they often, just don't have their ears to that.
Well, and so the police, for instance, statistically, the crime rate is mostly down. Recently, the murder rate has gone up. But if you listen to the news, you'd think that we need a huge police force.
Yeah, for sure. And oftentimes I watch other local media productions that it's just kind of republishing what the police, that their police are their biggest source, and they feel like they need to keep their news production going, that they have to keep that friendly relationship.
Well, so there's a reciprocal relationship with the police and the State Department as well, right?
Yeah, for sure. That I've been seeing all the China balloon coverage, and that maybe some of what's being reported is right, but it's how there's no question of narrative. It's just this is what the State Department said, and that's it.
Right, and George Santos, too, we're spending... I'm really sick of the George Santos story. There's more important things going on, like Cop City. You know, they're hardly reporting that at all. You mentioned Gannett. I noticed myself that Reuters and the AP, a lot of them are private entities, private newspapers that are beholden to their advertisers. So how accurate... are we going to get, how much accurate news are we going to get from, even though I think the AP is great, that it's a great association of news, the right idea, how accurate are we going to get from people that want to sell stuff or that are beholden to their advertisers?
Yeah, for sure. It's there's different models that I think would, if the Guard wasn't owned under Gannett or something, there's different models that would be more productive for the public if it was some sort of public trust or cooperative.
Or Pacifica is owned by the listeners.
Yeah.
The ones, kind of a co-op kind of thing, which has been pretty successful. And so what about... we're constantly at war, too. They seem to, almost like Orwell, they're talking about war. There was almost, Biden almost made a direct quote from Orwell where he's talking about the rocket bombs. They're killing innocent people with rocket bombs. And to justify war, is the media a product of the military-industrial complex?
Yeah, I think they're very tied up, too, that there's a lot of money in the, defense industry, all these military suppliers and other people that want to start these new wars and are able to get them through the media to drum up that pressure.
It seems like both sides,
Democrat
and Republican.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, so solutions journalism. I notice, and my example is the Maxine Waters thing, where the solutions are out there, and we know, the Poor People's Campaign, too, with Martin Luther King. We've known for over 50 years what the solution is to stop spending so much money on war and spend it on... welfare, or the defund the police thing. I notice right here in Eugene, the sheriff got up there one day and said that it would be cheaper for him to help a welfare mother, for instance, stay off the street rather than arrest her. It would be cheaper, and so we started this defund the police meaning, you know, we need more social programs, and that has been twisted into we want to abolish the police. And yes, ultimately we would abolish the police, but that's not what the defund the police movement was about at all. Anything twisting the message.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm in favor of police abolition, but it's like having, here's our long-term goal and lining out, here are some steps we can do in the interim. And there's definitely different ways you can go about that. And also, like, back to his solutions, that whenever I'm writing an article, I lay out, here's kind of what the problem is, but then also, like, hey, here's the organization you can plug in. Here's the next event you can go to, a rally, or this group is doing a fundraiser. Here's how you can chip in. And all in a news story, but also people should be able to plug in. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I notice they don't, like NPR, if I hear about it at all, I hear about it after the fact. They never tell me that there's going to be a demonstration. Do you think that's intentional? That isn't really a call to action, I don't think. Announcing that there is going to be a demonstration is not a call to action. You're not saying go down there and break windows. Why do you think, do you notice that NPR you don't find out about it until after the fact?
Yeah, a lot of times it's like they just want to create this small package. Here's a story, and we're kind of done with it. And it's also like they want to somehow divorce themselves from these movements. But I think you can still be, like, even, like, somebody like NPR wants to be impartial, it's still important for your readers to know how this is going to unfold more.
Well, that reminds me, is there such a thing as non-biased journalism, or can it... I noticed they can take non-biased journalism to the point where they're actually censoring themselves, and that's an example, is they're not telling you about... an upcoming demonstration. Is there such a thing as non-biased news?
Yeah, I think it's really most people have their own bias, and it's just kind of better to be lay them out. Here's where I'm coming from, and let your readers know about that.
And then my big issue is context, too, is why I think you've touched on soundbites. You don't agree with soundbites. But the example I always give is, like, for instance, Israel, when they report on Israel, they're taking it out of context in that it's about, much of Israel is about oil, but it's also mostly about weapons sales. And AIPAC is the largest... lobbyist by far, more so than all the others put together, and they don't put it in a context of the military industrial complex. I think, is that, what do you think of putting things in context?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of times it is the bias that, like, leaves out the maybe that context, or, but it's also like sometimes a not doing due diligence of, like, reading up on everything. But it's kind of, I think you should kind of explain your subjects. Yeah, and if there is, like, this key financial ties, that's pretty important to the story.
Well, then, so this balloon story and the George Santos story, I noticed those stories come up right when we start winning and start calling attention to something, like, yeah. Like defund the police or Cop City. All of a sudden, the narrative changes. Anything on that?
Yeah, I think the state is pretty good at, like, disrupting protests and movements by just... pouring their message into the press, like that they have multiple tools and one of them is that press line.
Well, and one thing I noticed too is, the press will never tell you that there's going to be a landslide in the election. Even when Obama, the landslide, they didn't really say that there was going to be a landslide because they want to sell advertising. And so they want you listening to the news, and they do it with the weather too, that, they want you listening to the news. So they're not going to tell you, that there's going to be a landslide, that they know that there's going to be a landslide in an election, for instance.
Yeah, for sure. It's the kind of horse race stuff is sensationalizing stuff is profitable and grabs attention.
Now, this may be my own thing, but I notice I think the news is also divisive, too, including NPR. They're constantly doing identity politics, which I guess liberals are in favor, but I come from the old George, there's an old George Carlin quote where he says they're constantly trying to divide us. Anything they can find to divide you, sexuality, race. And so in my opinion, that it's the news reporting is meant to keep you, rather than all of us get together and throw off the oligarchs, the elite class, we're all fighting amongst, they keep us fighting amongst each other. Anything on that?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something they can do, and it kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, like creating these more stories for them and help distract from more important stuff.
So are you familiar with, we touched on this a little bit, but are you familiar with Mockingbird, where the CIA has people, at least some type of representative on almost every major media, including the New York Times, and this is part of the reciprocal relationship. Is that true? Do you think that the CIA puts people on the staff of major newspapers like Newsweek and
I don't know if it's as true anymore, but I think there's certain reporters that like intelligence officials have a good relationship with and which helps them.
It just, that just reminds me of, I can never get their names right, but it's, remember, you may not be old enough to remember, James Clavell and Mary Madeline, I can never get their names right. Those two were actually married to each other, and they're one is the operative for the Republicans, and the other is the operative for the Democrats, and they're actually married to one another. And the press would just put them on debating each other, and don't, wouldn't it be important to just mention that these two are married to one another?
Yeah, for sure.
Anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think follow along with Solid News. Looking forward to the Pilk Conference coming up, and they're bringing back the Outlaw Bash.
Outlaw Bash? What? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so it's been one of the biggest events that where activists, organizers can meet up with each other, have discussions. Happens right during the Pilk weekend, and there's music going on, and people are able to connect in a scene.
Well, gee, I haven't heard about that from the local Oregon, the local NPR station, and I don't. And you know, they never report on Pilk either over there at KLCC. Well, so what about? So tell me about the story that you broke. The story. How did you do that?
Yeah. So I've been reporting on the Starbucks Union since it first formed, starting as just one store on 29th and Willamette. I saw a post on Reddit about it, and I started messaging around. I was able to talk directly to the worker, and I've been, since that's gone down, there's like 7 Starbucks around the city, and there's one in Springfield. I've gone union, and just showing up to their rallies and strikes and creating those contacts and staying close to the scene.
Right, so that reminds me that labor is another, that's another bone of contention with alternative media, is that most newspapers don't have a labor section. They have a business section, they have a sports section, but there is no labor section. Are they reporting these union movements enough? You realize there's a, I just came from a student meeting last night, and there's a whole student, they're trying to unionize the U of O right now, and that's not being reported that I know of at all. So what about, is there a dearth of labor reporting?
Yeah, many publications have cut their labor reporters, or because of province end, have never even had those on staff. And so when they they'll either not cover these labor stories, or they'll, like you're saying, they'll put a business reporter on it, and it'll miss key details and be very slanted towards the side of the businesses. And when I hear them talk about unions and like how unions are formed and what it means to be in a union, it's often just wrong. They're missing the basic details.
All right, so, and then I noticed, I just want to mention, we got the Super Bowl coming up here, which I call it Wife Beating Day, because that's the day that more women get beaten, at least it used to be. What, anything, I know there's an inordinate amount of media coverage of sports, and I just wonder, you know, if, I've always said if we stopped professional sports until we solved homelessness or something, I think we would solve homelessness almost overnight. Anything on how much time we spend, the media spends on sports?
Yeah, for sure. It's often with like Super Bowl, a lot of times people just write those stories, because then when people are searching for Super Bowl, their stories, they want their stories to come up. And but also the sports has been overcovered, and they get a lot more money than these better investigative routes. I've been doing a lot of, or doing more investigative, like doing public records requests. And so it's interesting, I'm able to look at the yo post all of the public records requests. But anyway, so you look at the logs, and much of these requests are for like, hey, how much is the coach getting paid? How much is for this game? And it's like, there's much more, there's better information that the university has that you can be looking for than just this sports stuff.
Journalistic integrity is, when I look it up, it's kind of an esoteric thing. And there's a thing called truthiness, that what is true now, there may be some scientific discoveries or some kind of evidence that has appeared that now that is not the truth anymore. And so now this is the truth. What, and this gets to, you know, what do we do? What's wrong with Facebook, and what should people be doing instead of relying on Facebook? How much responsibility does the user have, the consumer of media have, to seek out diverse opinions and educate themselves.
Yeah, I think it is important to have some sort of media literacy. I don't see that taught as much, and it's important to know, look into who is reporting this and what have they reported on for. Is this a trusted source? I don't think it's all on the readers, because there's just a lot of garbage that's being laid out there, and it's through multiple channels, but media literacy is key.
Well, should we rely on one source for all our information? And is that, I mean, even if you had one source that was a good source, how long is that going to last? Ultimately, if there's nobody else there, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I would think that even if we had one source for news, it would not last as a, its integrity would erode without anybody, if it was the sole source.
Yeah, I think it is important to have multiple sources, at least a handful of publications of, hey, here's the ones I'm going to be checking, and if seeing when different reports are in conflict.
I was just watching this... I'm watching a lot of documentaries on YouTube, and there's this one, an old one, where what this guy is saying is, he's talking about the commodification of the news, and he's saying, how can you take a report seriously on murder or rape or whatever, and then you right away you go to a commercial to sell soap. One minute the guy's telling you about this serious thing, and then you... cut to commercial when everybody knows that it's only going to be 8 minutes. You're only going to spend 8 minutes on this thing, and then you're going to go sell some a car or something. Anything on that?
Nowadays, I think the everything that's on TV has to fill up with a bunch of advertisements, and you're not able to get the long enough news statement, and for sure it's hard to take them seriously with the kind of advertisements that they have.
All right, so what's next for Solidarity News? Where are you going?
So I think it's, yeah, I'm gonna keep putting out the newsletter, and I think there's definitely lots of labor news I'm keeping up with, and some environmental organizing that's happening that's pretty important.
So you're going to be out on the streets, on the scene. You're going to be the man on the street,
yeah,
at these things to give so people will actually know what happened.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye on the organizations and people that are organizing.
All right, Matthew from Solidarity News, thanks very much for coming in. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buying coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored. And experience
your psychic. From the earliest days, freedom of the press was what defined America. Thomas Jefferson, who helped write the Declaration of Independence, believed a free media was essential for a free nation, saying, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." That was in 1787. Today, our newspapers seem to be fading in importance in a multimedia world. that is largely owned and controlled by a handful of large media corporations.
I think we're probably the most media-dominated society in the world.
Jeff Cohn worked in major media. Now he's one of the industry's fiercest critics.
Half a dozen corporations own and control most of the mainstream media in our country. So if you're looking at who rules America or who owns America, it's the same people that propagandize to America.
The press and the outlets that report news or convey information are just a small slice of vast media empires producing entertainment products that also sell a way of life based on consumption.
When you look at who's on the boards of media corporations, they're also on the boards of U.S. oil companies, and they're on the boards of U.S. military contractors. So trying to study who owns America, you're really also, these are the people that own the media. We don't have a state media, but in some ways it's very much like a state media. It's the corporate state.
If this is true, then we can say that the American media doesn't just report news. As we'll see, it's not independent of the system, but a pillar of it. It reinforces the worldview and defends the interests of those who rule America. Thirty years ago, 50 companies dominated American media. Now it's down to 6. Here are some charts on media ownership that illustrate this concentration. With new global digital enterprises like Google, Facebook, and Twitter growing in importance worldwide, U.S.-based media became a transnational force. The U.S. media companies are themselves owned in large part by hedge funds, mutual funds, and finance companies. Barry James Dyke is an asset manager who has studied media ownership.
The research which I've done is unequivocal, and I kind of stumbled into this, is that the media companies, the major media companies, i.e. the Disneys, the CBSs, the news corporations, all of them, this is all public documents, is that they're all owned by mutual fund companies. The majority shareholders are owned by mutual fund companies. So, and also, they also get a lot of their revenue from these companies. So you're never going to see any consistent criticism about these fund companies.
Are these companies investigated by the media?
No, they're not.
Are they responsible to the public in some way? Are they accountable? Do the public really know what they're doing?
The public really doesn't have a clue. They really don't know what they're doing.
He has documented his findings with charts in his own book, The Pirates of Manhattan.
Well, people are not going to be not getting the truth.
But there is a lot of coverage, especially of politics, that's often treated as a sporting event, with an emphasis on poll numbers and election results. Mary Boyle follows media coverage of elections for Common Cause.
What about the role of the media? Is the media helping to strengthen our democracy, or do you think it's helping to divide us?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think that, there are a couple of things going on there. Obviously, you've got kind of cable channels that are, you know, in different camps, and they are not showing different points of view. You've got Fox News showing the right. You've got MSNBC showing the left. And so with a setup like that, you have Americans that are just kind of tuning in to the channel they want to listen to that, you know, kind of expresses their views, and you're not seeing kind of a mix of an opinion, a debate, anything like that. You've also got, you know, the shrinkage of the media. You've got less coverage of what's going on. And I think this is particularly concerning more around kind of state-based and local politics, where there's even less coverage of what's going on in politics.
But even as the world is known for its diversity, American media is not. Editorially and ideologically, the power elite tends to reflect the views of the government and the people who shape its views. Dissenting politicians like Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. have a hard time getting their views heard.
Who owns the media? How the media is translated, some of the moguls and the titans of media and industry are part of the problem. They shape a narrative for the American people, a narrative that ultimately leads millions of people to vote for candidates based upon the narrative that they shape, based upon the talking heads that they control. And those Americans tend to vote and tend to engage the system on the basis of that which they hear. Media is a significant part of this problem.
Historian Eric Foner agrees. He says it's not just political bias at work, but what the media as a business feels it's forced to focus on to attract ratings and revenues.
Somehow, that idea of power behind the people in office is not really in our media very much. It's not really in people's minds very much. They personalize politics. There are personalities combating each other, but they don't look at who's behind the scenes.
Well, you're quite right that the media focuses on personalities, you know, and often the quirks of personality, Clinton's sexual escapades, or whether Obama was born in the United States or not, or Romney and his cars and whatever, you know, his not paying taxes and many other things. Those are not totally unimportant issues, but maybe it's the nature of the media today in and of itself, in that it has to go for the quick news. Deep investigative reporting is not emphasized as much as perhaps it was in the past. And, you got to sell papers, and scandal sells papers, personality sells papers, celebrity sells papers. So you're right that the larger nature of how the system operates tends not to get emphasized as much.
It's not even understood by many people.
Well, it's hard to understand. This is a very large country, over 300 million people, a very, very complicated economy and political system. So it's difficult to understand exactly how things operate. But I think, in a certain sense, the anti-government sentiment, which is rife in this country, which is generally associated with the right wing, is also a response to the feeling. It's an inchoate feeling. It's not an analytical feeling, but it's a feeling that government is aloof. It is not responsive. It does not really represent the people. It represents some very particular interests, and that sense is pretty widespread in this country.
Media watch groups are also concerned about the lack of diversity within the media that makes it unrepresentative of the country it serves in racial, ethnic, and gender terms.
The unwritten credo of the New York Times is do not alienate those for whom we depend for money and access.
Chris Hedges was an award-winning journalist for the New York Times, an American media star.
And that means the power elite and the financiers who advertise. But it's expandable. I mean, you have at least in the positions that I was in, the possibility to do journalism. Not that there aren't, restrictions or constrictions. There are, and not that they can't be punishing.
Hedges' work is still very respected. But he believes that much of the press is ultimately a charade that covers up for power more than covers it, especially when reporting on elections.
Because the political theater, I mean, the personal narrative of the candidate, it's all irrelevant. It's meaningless. And people, we still play the game. Look, every totalitarian country I covered had elections. They all play the charade. I mean, even East Germany did. And that's the charade we play. And when we have a compliant corporate media that pretends that charade is real. So I think the problem is that the illusion still remains so powerful. But people are changing, but the illusion is still so powerful that people confuse where power actually exists.
How does the New York Times cover the power centers that many people say rule America? Chris Spanos edits the New York Times Examiner that monitors the newspaper's content every day. He believes the paper has become an accomplice to the power elite.
The New York Times as an institution is almost like a mini nation, and the correspondents, the op-ed writers, the editors, they're almost like diplomats in how they carry themselves and their own self-importance and in the way that they communicate with other politicians and diplomats, and they are very influential.
Would you say that they're a disseminator of ideology in America, not just of information?
absolutely. They disseminate a very particular ideology, and that their readership is primarily managers and people who make around over $90,000 a year, and so they cater to a managerial perspective, and so they have a pro-management when they're discussing labor relations. They often have a pro-management view, a pro-business view.
Financial journalists like Stacey Herbert and Max Kaiser found that many pro-business views in some media outlets were often uninformed, as they told me on a radio show.
From December 2008, so well after the collapse of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, the market's tumbling 1,000 points in a day, and the head of BBC World News Business said, and we had a 10-episode contract, "Do you think the financial crisis will last all the way through these 10 episodes?
So in other words, the people actually in charge of planning the coverage are very uninformed themselves.
Well, the mainstream media are themselves deeply in debt. You know, the news organizations have become entertainified, and to compete, they take on enormous amounts of debt. So the bankers, they don't want to insult their creditors because they might cut off their lines of credit. So they don't have, they're not unbiased in this regard in any stretch of the imagination. You see this most spectacularly with the New York Times. Their coverage of the Wall Street is pitiful.
Welcome to my world.
One reason the press is so pro-business is that they are themselves businesses. The people who run media companies increasingly pay themselves huge salaries and bonuses the same way that bankers do, says Barry Dyke.
Yeah, Les Moonves, I couldn't believe it. He made $59 million in 2009, and he racked up, it was just disclosed the other day, that he made close to $70 million in 2010.
And that's the head of CBS.
That's the head of CBS.
But you're saying that all of them are really running their businesses as if they were banks.
I mean, that's pretty good. That's banker pay. I mean, $70 million is a lot of money in anyone's book, and that's what they're getting paid.
So the media companies are really part of this whole system of who rules America. They're part of these interlocking relationships with financial institutions.
There's no question about it. You get the media companies, which are huge. It's part of the empire. You get the media companies, you get the bankers, of course. You have your massive, you know, unions, okay? You have other factors as well. But the media is definitely part of it, and the asset managers.
That's exactly it. The corporations that own the U.S. media and own U.S. television are very wealthy and very powerful. And the people at the top of the news networks get paid an awful lot of money. I have never earned anything close to the amount of money I earned in the 1 year I worked where General Electric was my boss at MSNBC. So what I think happens is a self-censorship where the people who rise to the top have learned how not to rock any boats. And they know if they do rock boats, they will lose their huge salaries.
Newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal tend to frame a deeper narrative that tells us what we should believe matters. They set the agenda that influences what TV news programs also cover. For example, they don't focus on inequality and class differences, says independent media executive Brian Drouillet.
They don't talk about the working class. And part of it is, it's like the idea that, you know, they promote this idea that, you know, if you buy a lottery ticket, you could win, right? So you're already thinking that maybe you could win. So if you're in the working class, or you're part of the working class that's unemployed, you still have this hope that somehow you're going to go into the middle class.
There's been very little attention paid to class. I mean, you were saying that the media really doesn't discuss this. They don't really highlight class differences in America. They're much more comfortable talking about racial differences or ethnic differences. At the same time, in their business practices, they're very conscious of demographics. What class are they attracting? Upper class, how to cater their advertising, how to sell it.
No, they go, I mean, you know, the internet is a perfect example of that. Google and everything, where they're constantly slicing and dicing who you are, so they know exactly how much you make, so they can pitch what kind of products to you. But that's this whole sort of madness of the consumer society that's been created by modern capitalism. But the key thing I think that you're getting at is that even though there is a reality of class, a working class in this country and a ruling class or a bourgeois class, people have been trained not to think in those terms, so they don't even know who they are.
Some networks, like Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch, seem to be more comfortable presenting a right-wing political line. They have helped shift many media outlets to the right.
There is a school of thought that says we should have given the citizens of Baghdad 48 hours to get out of Dodge and flatten the place. Then the war would be already over, and we could have done that in 2 days.
That may be so, but old media is being eclipsed by the new, says George Scribner, the vice president of Digitas, a company that comes up with digital strategies for big companies and studies how affluent consumers now drive marketing in an era of growing economic inequality.
The one thing that's different now is that the media is owned by everyone. You know, the thing that's kind of leveling off the dollars to some extent is that everyone has access to Twitter, everyone has access to blogging, and there's this new kind of fast and fluid coalition building. Like Occupy Wall Street was one example of that. The Arab Spring was an example of that. So in some ways, kind of there's a new check and balance. I don't think that's necessarily changing the restructuring of income and wealth, but I do think there's another trip switch that might help us when things get too bad.
So the digital media, in a
yes.
way, is where democracy
exactly.
is today. It's not in politics,
yes.
it's not in big business, it's not in big money.
That's true. I think that's well said.
There is some debate on how free the internet really is, given corporate control and government censorship, but it does make possible more interactivity. At the same time, media attention still tends to revolve around a political elite with authority, even if that elite doesn't necessarily have the power to shape priorities or impose policies.
But when you talk to ordinary Americans, many of them feel it's totally fair.
Yeah.
They're seeing different points of view. They're seeing people who are critical from time to time. They see the media as the liberal media in some instances.
I was in the Soviet Union, and we were always raised in this country that that's pure propaganda. And frankly, it was very ineffective propaganda because they never pretended to have two points of view. They would have some one point of view saying how great things are. But in our country, propaganda is really effective because they have the appearance of debates.
The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world.
Jeff Cohn says that just as Americans were misled about Iraq before the war, they are being misled today about Iran. He pointed to a study about Iraq before the American invasion that found that of some 393 people who were interviewed on all the networks, only three were anti-war.
Because almost everything we knew about Iraq before the invasion turned out to be false. And almost everything we're learning today about Iran is not accurate. And we went to the New York Times a couple months ago where they said that the International Atomic Energy Association has put out an assessment that the nuclear program in Iran has a military objective. And FAIR, this media criticism group, went to the Times and said, which report is that? We've never heard of it. The Times knew they'd made a big error. It was a prominent error. They removed the sentence from their website, but they refused to correct the error.
It's not just wars that get propagandized. Media does not often cover the people behind the scenes who run things, says William Hartung, who has written about the military-industrial complex.
You would think there would be some independence in the journalism on this issue. But in some cases, reporters have even said to me, well, you know, I can't go after the Pentagon harder or the companies harder. Or this nexus of influence harder because this company is a big advertiser in the paper, and we'll get pressure, you know, if we do those kinds of stories. So we'll do stories about the war in Afghanistan. We'll repeat what the president has to say on an issue, but there's not really a lot of interest or resources put into investigating these kinds of connections.
David Swanson, who also writes about military policy, agrees.
Well, the corporate media in the United States is integrated with the military-industrial complex. Some of the same corporations are making profits from both. There are major political parties that don't have much disagreement on this topic, so it's not a topic for debate. No matter if 90% of the public is upset about it, it's not acceptable news.
Michael Clare, who's investigated the destructive power of oil and gas companies, says the same is true when it comes to that industry.
The media doesn't cover this for the most part. In fact, the media is largely in league because of the advertising dollars that the oil and gas lobby provides. They're very heavily dependent on advertising revenue, so they're very careful in what they say.
I'm here.